Es ist die alte Geschichte. The conquerors don't understand why people want nothing to do with them. After 1918, you tried in vain to make us believe that we were stubborn, because we couldn't forget our sunken fleet, our lost colonies, our destroyed empire. But how can you compare the resentment of a great nation with one farmer's blind outburst of hatred? Lucille picked a few sprigs of mignonette, smelled them, crushed them in her hands. Has he been caught? She asked. No. Oh, he'll be long gone by now. None of these good people would dare hide him. They know only too well they'd be risking their own lives, and they're fond of their lives, aren't they? Almost as fond of their lives as their money. Smiling slightly, he looked around at all the low, squat, secret houses slumbering in the dusk. She could see he was imagining them full of chatty and emotional old women, prudent and nitpicking middle-class ladies, and further away in the countryside, farmers who were more like animals. It was almost true, partly true. Yet there remained something shadowy, mysterious, impossible to articulate, and over which, Lucille suddenly thought, remembering something she'd read at school, even the proudest tyrant will never rule. "Let's walk on a bit further," he said. The path was lined with lilies. Their silky buds had burst open under the last rays of the sun, and now the sweet-smelling flowers blossomed proudly in the night air. During the 3 months they had known each other, Lucille and the German had taken many walks together, but never in such splendid weather, so conducive to love. By tacit agreement, they tried to forget everything except each other. It's nothing to do with us. It's not our fault. In the heart of every man and every woman, a kind of Garden of Eden endures, where there is no war, no death, where wild animals and deer live together in peace. All we have to do is to reclaim that paradise. Just close our eyes to everything else. We are a man and a woman. We love each other. Reason and emotion, they both believed, could make them enemies, but between them was a harmony of the senses that nothing could destroy, the silent understanding that binds a man in love and a willing woman in mutual desire. In the shade of a cherry tree, heavy with fruit, near the little fountain where the frogs croaked, he had to have her. He pulled her into his arms with a violence he couldn't control, tearing at her clothes, crushing her breasts. "No, never!" she cried out. "Never!" Never would she be his. She was afraid of him. She no longer craved his touch. She wasn't depraved enough, or too young perhaps, to allow her fear to be transformed into desire. The love she had welcomed so willingly that she didn't believe it could be shameful suddenly seemed to her disgraceful madness. She was lying. She was betraying him. How could you call that love? What had it been then? Simply a moment of pleasure? But she was incapable of feeling even pleasure. What now made them enemies was neither reason nor emotion, but the secret movements of blood they had counted on to unite them and over which they were powerless. He touched her with his beautiful slim hands. She had so desired them, yet she felt nothing, nothing but the cold buckle of his uniform pressing against her chest, which froze her to the core. Was whispering to her in German. Foreigner, foreigner, enemy in spite of everything. Forever he would be the enemy with his green uniform, with his heavenly beautiful hair and his confident mouth. Suddenly it was he who pushed her away.
"I won't take you by force. I'm not a drunken boor. Just go."
But the chiffon ties of her dress were caught on the officer's metal buttons. Slowly, his hand shaking, he freed her. She, meanwhile, was looking anxiously towards the house. The first lamps were being lit. Would Madame Angelier remember to close both sets of curtains so the fugitive silhouette couldn't be seen through the window? People weren't careful enough on these beautiful June evenings. Secrets were revealed through open bedroom windows where anyone could see in. People weren't careful enough. They could distinctly hear the English radio coming from a neighbouring house. The cart passing by on the road was full of contraband. Weapons were hidden in every home. His head bowed. Bruno held the long ties of her flowing belt in his hands.
"I thought,"
he finally said sadly. He stopped, hesitated, then continued, that you cared for me.
I thought so too.
And you don't?
No. It cannot be.
She took a few steps back and stood slightly away from him. For a moment they just looked at each other. The heart-rending blast of a trumpet sounded. It was curfew. The German soldiers walked through groups of people in the village square.
Go along now, time for bed,
they said politely. The women protested and laughed. The trumpet blasted again. The locals went home. The Germans remained. The sound of their monotonous rounds was the only thing that would be heard until daybreak.
It's curfew, said Lucille impassively. I have to go back. I have to close all the windows. I was told yesterday at headquarters that the light from the sitting room wasn't blocked out enough.
As long as I am here, you don't have to worry about anything. No one will bother you.
She didn't reply. She held out her hand to him. He kissed it, and she walked back to the house.
Long after midnight, he was still walking around in the garden. She could hear the brief, monotonous calls of the guards in the street, and beneath her window, her jailer's slow, steady walk. Sometimes she thought, he loves me. He doesn't suspect anything. And sometimes, he's suspicious. He's watching. He's waiting.
It's such a shame, she thought in a sudden moment of honesty. It's such a shame. It was a beautiful night, a night made for love. We shouldn't have wasted it. The rest isn't important.
But she stayed where she was. She didn't get out of her bed to go to the window. She felt bound and gagged, a prisoner, united with this captive land that dreamed and sighed softly with impatience. She let the empty night drift by. Chapter 21. The village had been looking cheerful all afternoon. In the square, the soldiers had decorated the flagpoles with leaves and flowers, and on the balcony of the municipal hall, red and black banners with Gothic writing floated below the swastikas. It was a beautiful day. The flags and banners billowed in the soft, cool breeze. Two young soldiers with pink faces were pushing a cart full of roses.
Are they for the tables?
The women asked, curious.
Yes,
the soldiers proudly replied. One of them picked out a rosebud and, with an exaggerated salute, offered it to a young girl who blushed.
It'll be a wonderful party. Wir hoffen es, we hope so. We're going to a lot of trouble,
the soldiers replied. The cooks were working outdoors preparing pâtés and cakes for the dinner. To avoid the dust, they'd set up beneath the great lime trees that surrounded the church. The head chef, in uniform but wearing a high hat and apron of dazzling white to protect his jacket, was putting the finishing touches to an enormous gâteau. He decorated it with cream swirls and candied fruit. The smell of sugar filled the air. The children squealed with delight. The head chef, bursting with pride but trying not to show it, frowned and scolded them.
All right, back up a bit. How do you expect us to work with you crowding around?
At first, the women pretended not to be interested in the cake.
Ugh, it'll be horrible. They don't have the right kind of flour.
Gradually, they moved closer, shyly at first, then more confidently. Eventually, they found the audacity to start giving advice, as women do.
Hey, monsieur, there's not enough decoration on this side. You need some angelica.
They ended up helping. Pushing back the delighted children, they bustled about round the table with the Germans. One of them chopped the almonds, another crushed the sugar.
Is it just for the officers, or will the ordinary soldiers have some too? They asked. It's for everyone, everyone. Everyone except us, they sniggered.
The head chef raised the earthenware platter holding the enormous cake, and with a little salute showed it to the crowd, who laughed and applauded. Then he carefully laid it on a huge wooden plank carried by two soldiers, one at the head, one at the foot, and they all set off for the chateau.
Meanwhile, officers invited from all the regiments billeted in the area began to arrive. Their long green capes floated behind them. The shopkeepers stood in front of their doors, smiling at them. They had been bringing up their remaining supplies from the cellar since morning. The Germans were buying everything they had and paying well. One officer snapped up the last few bottles of Benedictine brandy. Another paid 1,200 francs for lingerie for his wife. The soldiers crowded round the shop windows and looked lovingly at the pink and blue bibs. Finally, one of them couldn't help himself, and as soon as the officer had gone, he called a saleswoman over and pointed to some baby clothes. He was very young, with blue eyes.
"Boy? Girl?" the saleswoman asked.
"I don't know," he said ingenuously. "My wife will write and tell me. It happened during my last leave a month ago." Everyone around him started laughing. He blushed, but seemed very happy. He bought a rattle and a little robe. He came back across the road in triumph. They were rehearsing the music in the village square. Next to the circle formed by the drums, the trumpets and the fifes, another circle formed round the regimental postmaster. The Frenchman noted the open mouths and eyes bright with hope, and nodded politely, thinking sadly, "We know what it's like when you're waiting for news from another country. We've all done that." Meanwhile, an enormous young German, with huge thighs and a fat bottom that threatened to split his tight riding breeches, entered the Hôtel des Voyageurs and for the third time asked to look at the barometer. It was still set at fair. The German, beaming with delight, said,
"Nothing to worry about, no storm tonight. Gott mit uns."
"Yes, yes," the waitress nodded in agreement. This innocent delight spread to the customers and the owner himself, who supported the British. Everyone stood up and went over to the barometer.
"Nothing to worry about. Nothing is good. Nice party," they said, deliberately speaking in pidgin French so he'd understand them better.
And the German slapped everyone on the back with a wide grin while repeating,
"Gott mit uns." "Sure, sure. Gott mit uns."
"He's drunk, that Fritz," they whispered behind his back, rather sympathetically. "We know what it's like. He's been celebrating since yesterday. He's a big lad." "Well, so what? Why shouldn't they have fun? They're men, after all." Having created a sympathetic atmosphere with his words and appearance, and after downing three bottles of beer one after the other, the German, beaming, finally left. As the day progressed, all the local people began to feel happy and light-headed, as if they too would be going to the ball. In the kitchens, the young girls listlessly rinsed the glasses and every few minutes leaned out of the window to watch the groups of Germans going up to the chateau.
"Did you see the second lieutenant who lives at the church house? Isn't he handsome with his smooth skin? There's the commandant's new interpreter. How old is he, do you think?"
"I'd say he couldn't be more than 20, that boy. They're all so young."
"Oh, there's the Angelier's lieutenant. He'd drive me wild, he would. You can tell he's a gentleman. What a beautiful horse. They really do have beautiful horses, by God."
The young girls sighed. Then the bitter voice of some old man dozing by the stove called out,
"Sure they do. They're our horses."
The old man spat into the fire, muttering curses that the young girls didn't hear. They were only interested in one thing, to hurry and finish the dishes so they could go and watch the Germans at the chateau. Running alongside the grounds was a path lined with acacias, lime trees, and beautiful aspens with leaves that incessantly trembled, incessantly rustled in the wind. Between the branches it was possible to see the lake and the lawns where the tables had been set up. And on the hill, the chateau, its doors and windows wide open, where the regimental orchestra would play. By 8 o'clock, everyone in the village was there. The young girls had dragged their parents along. Children that the young women hadn't wanted to leave at home were sleeping in their mother's arms, or running about, shouting and playing with the pebbles. Some pushed aside the soft branches of the acacia trees and watched the scene with curiosity. The musicians on the terrace, the German officers lying on the grass or slowly strolling through the trees, the tables covered with dazzling linen, the silver reflecting the last rays of the sun, and behind each chair a soldier standing as still as if he were at inspection, the orderlies who would act as waiters. The orchestra played a particularly lively, cheerful song. The officers took their places. Before sitting down, the head of the table, the place of honour, a general, whispered the French, and all the other officers stood at attention, raised their glasses and shouted, "Heil Hitler!" It took a long time for the roar to subside. It reverberated through the air with a pure, fierce, metallic echo. Then they could hear the hubbub of conversations, the clinking of cutlery, and the sound of the night birds singing. The Frenchmen strained to see if they could recognise people they knew. Next to the general with the white hair, delicate features and long, hooked nose were the officers from headquarters.
"That one over there on the left. Look, he's the one who took my car, the bastard.
The little blonde one with a rosy complexion next to him, he's nice. He talks good French."
"Where's the Angelier's German? He's called Bruno. Pretty name. It's a shame it'll be dark soon. We won't be able to see anything then."
"The shoemakers, Fritz, told me they were going to light torches."
"Oh, Mummy, that'll be so pretty. Let's stay till then."
"What will the owners of the chateau be saying about all this? They won't be able to sleep tonight."
"Who's going to eat the leftovers? Who, Mummy? The mayor?"
"Oh, be quiet, you silly thing. There won't be any leftovers. They've got hearty appetites."
Little by little, darkness spread across the lawns. They could still make out the gold decorations on the uniforms, the German's blonde hair, the musicians' brass instruments on the terrace, but they'd lost their glow. All the light of the day, fleeing the earth, seemed for one brief moment to take refuge in the sky. Pink clouds spiralled round the full moon that was as green as pistachio sorbet and as clear as glass. It was reflected in the lake. Exquisite perfumes filled the air. Grass, fresh hay, wild strawberries. The music kept playing. Suddenly, the torches were lit. As the soldiers carried them along, they cast their light over the messy tables, the empty glasses, for the officers were now gathered around the lake, singing and laughing. There was the lively, happy sound of champagne corks popping.
"Oh, those bastards, and to think it's our wine they're drinking," the Frenchman said, but without real bitterness, because all happiness is contagious and disarms the spirit of hatred. And of course the Germans seemed to like the champagne so much, and had paid so much for it, that the Frenchmen were vaguely flattered by their good taste.
"They're having a good time. Thank goodness it's not all war.
Oh, don't worry, they'll be fighting again.
They say it'll be over this year.
Sure, it would be bad if they won, but what can you do? It's got to end. Everyone's so miserable in the cities, and we want our prisoners back."
All along the road, the young girls held each other by the waist and danced to the soft, lively music. The drums and brass instruments gave the waltzes and tunes from operettas a bright tone that was victorious, happy, heroic and joyous, that made their hearts beat faster. Sometimes a low, prolonged, powerful note rose above the lively arpeggios, like the echo of a distant storm. When it was completely dark, they started singing. Groups of soldiers sang to one another from the terrace and the park, from the banks of the lake and the lake itself, where boats, decorated with flowers, drifted past. The Frenchmen listened, delighted in spite of themselves. It was nearly midnight, but no one would have dreamed of leaving their spot in the tall grass or between the branches. Only the burning torches and sparklers lit up the trees. Wonderful voices filled the night. Suddenly, there was a long silence. They could see the Germans running like shadows against a background of green flame and moonlight.
"They're going to light the fireworks," shouted a little boy. "They're definitely having fireworks. I know, the Fritz told me."
His shrill voice could be heard down by the lake. His mother scolded him.
"Be quiet. You're not allowed to call them Fritz or Bosch. Not ever. They don't like it. Just be quiet and watch."
But they couldn't see anything now, except the shadows of men scurrying about. From the terrace, someone shouted something they couldn't make out. It provoked a long, low commotion like rumbling thunder.
"What are they shouting about? Could you hear?"
"It must be Heil Hitler, Heil Göring, Heil the Third Reich, or something like that." "We can't hear a thing now.
They're not talking any more.
Look, the musicians are leaving. Do you think they've had some news?
Do you think they've invaded England?"
Well, I think they just got cold outside and they're moving the party inside the chateau, said the pharmacist pointedly. He was worried about the night dampness because of his rheumatism. He took his young wife's arm. Why don't we go home too, Lynette? But she wouldn't hear of it.
Oh, let's stay just a little longer. They're going to sing again. It was so nice.
The French waited, but there was no more singing. Soldiers carrying torches were running between the chateau and the grounds as if they were conveying orders. There was even some shouting. Beneath the moonlight, empty boats drifted on the lake. All the officers had jumped out onto the bank. They were walking along, talking to each other quickly in loud voices. Although the French could hear them, no one understood what they were saying. One by one, the sparklers went out. The spectators began yawning.
Oh, it's late, let's go home. The party's definitely over.
They made their way in little groups back to the village, the young girls arm in arm walking in front of their parents, the sleepy children dragging their feet. When they got to the first house, they saw an old man sitting on a straw chair smoking his pipe.
Well, he said, is the party over then?
Yes, oh, they had such a good time.
Well, they won't be having a good time for long, the old man said calmly. I've just heard on the radio that they're at war with Russia.
He knocked his pipe against his chair several times to get rid of the ashes, then looked at the sky.
It'll be dry again tomorrow. Not good for the gardens, this weather.
Chapter 22
They're going!
For several days they'd been waiting for the Germans to leave. The soldiers themselves had announced it. They were being sent to Russia. When the French heard the news, they looked at them with curiosity. Are they happy? Worried? Will they win or lose? As for the Germans, they tried to work out what the French were thinking. Were they happy to see them go? Did they secretly wish they'd all get killed? Did anyone feel sorry for them? Would they miss them? Of course they wouldn't be missed as Germans, as conquerors. They weren't naive enough to think that. But would the French miss these Pauls, Siegfrieds, Oswalds, who had lived under their roofs for 3 months, showed them pictures of their wives and mothers, shared more than one bottle of wine with them? But both the French and the Germans remained inscrutable. They were polite, careful of what they said.
Well, that's war. We can't do anything about it, right? It won't last long. At least we hope not.
They said goodbye to one another, like passengers on a ship who've reached their final port of call. They would write to each other. They would see each other again some day. They would always remember the happy weeks they'd spent together. More than one soldier whispered to a pensive young girl,
"When the war is over, I'll come back."
When the war is over. How far away that was. They were leaving today, the 1st of July, 1941. The French were concerned primarily with the question of whether the village would be occupied by other soldiers, because if so, they thought bitterly, well, it wasn't worth going to the trouble of changing them. They were used to this lot. Maybe the new ones will be worse. Lucille slipped into Madame Angelier's room to tell her that it was definite. They'd received their orders. The Germans were leaving that very night. They could reasonably hope for at least a few hours' grace before any new soldiers arrived, and they should take advantage of this to help Benoit escape. It was impossible to hide him until the end of the war, equally impossible to send him home as long as the area remained occupied. There was only one hope, to get him across the demarcation line. However, the line was closely guarded, and would be even more so during the evacuation of the troops.
"It's dangerous," said Lucille, "very dangerous."
She looked pale and tired. For several nights she'd hardly slept. She looked at Benoit, standing opposite her. Her feelings towards him were an odd combination of fear, incomprehension, and envy. His calm, severe, almost brutal expression intimidated her. He was a big, muscular man with a ruddy complexion. Beneath thick eyebrows, his pale eyes were sometimes unbearable to look at. His tanned, lined hands were the hands of a labourer and a soldier, thought Lucille. Earth or blood, it was the same to him. Neither remorse nor sorrow troubled his sleep, of that she was sure. Everything was simple to this man.
"I've thought about it a lot, Madame Lucille," he said quietly.
Despite the fortress-like walls and closed doors, whenever all three of them were together, they felt they were being watched and said what they needed to very quickly and almost in a whisper. No one will be able to get me across the line. It's too risky. I know I have to leave, but I want to go to Paris. To Paris? While I was with the regiment, I had some friends. He hesitated. We were taken prisoner together. We escaped together. They work in Paris. If I can find them, they'll help me. One of them wouldn't be alive now if... He looked at his hands and fell silent. What I need is to get to Paris without getting arrested on the way and to find someone I can trust to put me up for a day or two until I find my friends. I don't know anyone in Paris, murmured Lucille. But in any case, you'll need identity papers. As soon as I find my friends, Madame Lucille, I'll be able to get hold of some papers. But how? What do your friends do? They're in politics, Benoit said curtly. Communists, murmured Lucille, recalling certain rumours she'd heard about Benoit's ideas and activities. The communists will be hunted down now. You're risking your life.
It won't be the first time, Madame Lucille, or the last, said Benoit. You get used to it.
And how will you get to Paris? You can't take the train. Your description is posted everywhere.
On foot, by bicycle. When I escaped, I was on foot. It don't scare me.
But the police... The people who put me up 2 years ago will remember me and won't shot me to the police.
It's safer than here, where plenty of people hate me. It'd be easier.
Such a long journey on foot, alone. Madame Angelier, who hadn't said a word until now, was standing next to the window, her pale eyes watching the Germans come and go across the village square. She raised her hand to warn them.
Someone's coming.
All three of them fell silent. Lucille's heart was pounding so violently, so quickly, that she was ashamed. The others could surely hear it, she thought. The old woman and the farmer remained impassive. They could hear Bruno's voice downstairs. He was looking for Lucille. He opened several doors.
Do you know where Madame Lucille is?
He asked the cook.
She's gone out,
Marthe replied. Lucille sighed with relief. I'd better go down, she said. He's looking for me to say goodbye.
Take advantage of it, Madame Angelier suddenly said, to ask him for a petrol coupon and a travel pass. You can take the old car, the one that wasn't requisitioned. You can tell the German you have to drive one of our tenant farmers to town because he's ill. With a pass from German headquarters, you won't be stopped, and you could make it safely to Paris.
But to lie like that, said Lucille in disgust.
What else have you been doing for the past 10 days?
And once we get to Paris, where will he hide until he finds his friends? Where will we find anyone courageous enough, committed enough, unless... She was remembering something. Yes, she said suddenly. It's possible. Anyway, it's a chance we'll have to take. Do you remember the refugees from Paris we helped in June 1940? They worked in a bank, quite an old couple, but full of spirit and courage. They wrote to me recently. I have their address. They're called Michaud. Yes, that's it. Jeanne and Maurice Michaud. They might do it. Of course they'll do it. But we'd have to write and ask and wait for their reply, or just take our chances and hope for the best. I don't know.
Ask for the pass in any case, said Madame Angelier. It shouldn't be difficult, she added with a faint, bitter smile.
I'll try, said Lucille.
She was dreading the moment she would be alone with Bruno. Nevertheless, she hurried down the stairs.
Best to get it over with. What if he suspects something?
Oh, so what? It was war. She would submit to the rules of war. She was afraid of nothing. Her empty, weary soul was almost eager to run some great risk. She knocked at the German's door. She went in and was surprised to find he was not alone. With him were the commandant's new interpreter, a thin, red-headed boy with a hard, angular face and blonde eyelashes, and another very young officer who was short and chubby with a rosy complexion and a childlike expression and smile. All three of them were writing letters and packing up. They were sending home all those little knick-knacks soldiers buy when they're in the same place for a while, to create the illusion they live there, but which are burdensome during a campaign, ashtrays, little clocks, prints, and especially books. Lucille wanted to go, but he asked her to stay. She sat down in an armchair Bruno brought out for her, and she watched the three Germans, who, after apologising, continued working.
We want to get all this in the post by 5 o'clock, they said.
She saw a violin, a small lamp, a French-German dictionary,
books in French, German and English, and a beautiful romantic print of a sailing boat at sea.
"I found it in Autun at a bric-a-brac shop," said Bruno.
He hesitated.
"Actually, better not. I won't post it. I don't have the right box for it. It'll get damaged. It would make me so very happy, madame, if you would keep it. It will brighten up this rather dark room. The subject is appropriate. Look. Dark, threatening skies. A ship setting sail. And far in the distance, a hint of brightness on the horizon. A vague, very faint glimmer of hope. Do accept it as a memento of a soldier who is leaving, and who will never see you again."
"I will, mein Herr," Lucille said quietly, "because of this hint of brightness on the horizon." He bowed and continued packing. A candle was lit on the table. He held the sealing wax over its flame, placed a seal on the finished package, took his ring off his hand, and pressed it into the hot wax. Lucille watched him, remembering the day he had played the piano for her, and how she had held the ring, still warm, from his hand. "Yes," he said, suddenly looking up at her. "The happy times are over." "Do you think this new war will last long?" she said, immediately regretting having asked. It was like asking someone if he thought he would live long. What did this new war mean? What was going to happen? A series of thundering victories or defeat? A long struggle? Who could really know? Who dared predict the future? Although that's all people did, and always in vain. He seemed to read her thoughts. "In any case," he said, "there will surely be much suffering, much heartache and much bloodshed." He and his two comrades were getting everything organized. The short officer was carefully wrapping up a tennis racket, and the interpreter some large, beautiful books bound in tan leather.
"Gardening books," he explained to Lucille. "Because in civilian life," he added in a slightly pompous tone of voice, "I design gardens in the classical style of Louis XIV. How many Germans in the village, in cafes, in the comfortable houses they had occupied, were now writing to their wives, their fiancées, leaving behind their worldly possessions as if they were about to die? Lucille felt deeply sorry for them. Outside in the street there were horses coming back from the blacksmith and saddle maker, all ready to leave, no doubt. It seemed strange to think about these horses, pulled away from their work in France to be sent to the other end of the world. The interpreter, who had been watching them go by, said seriously, "Where we are going is a really wonderful place for horses." The short lieutenant made a face. "Not so wonderful for men." The idea of this new war seemed to fill them with sadness, Lucille thought. But she didn't allow herself to dwell too deeply on their feelings. She feared to find, in the place of emotion, some spark of their so-called warrior mentality. It was almost like spying. She would have been ashamed to do it. But anyway, she knew them well enough by now to know they would put up a good fight. "What's more," she said to herself, "there's a world of difference between the young man I'm looking at now and the warrior of tomorrow. It's a truism that people are complicated, multifaceted, contradictory, surprising. But it takes the advent of war or other momentous events to be able to see it. It is the most fascinating and the most dreadful of spectacles," she continued thinking. "The most dreadful because it's so real. You can never pride yourself on truly knowing the sea unless you've seen it both calm and in a storm. Only the person who has observed men and women at times like this," she thought, "can be said to know them and to know themselves." She would never have believed herself capable of saying to Bruno in such ingenuous and sincere tones, "I've come to ask you a great favour." "Tell me, madame. How can I be of service to you?"
"Could you recommend me to someone at headquarters who could get me a travel pass and petrol coupon as a matter of urgency? I have to drive to Paris." As she was speaking, she was thinking, "If I tell him about some sick tenant farmer, he'll be suspicious. There are good hospitals in the area, in Creusot, Paris, or Autun.
I have to drive one of my farmers to Paris. His daughter works there. She's seriously ill and is asking for him. The poor man would lose too much time if he went by train. You know it's the harvest. If you could grant me permission, we could do the entire journey there and back in a day.
You don't need to go to headquarters, Madame Angelier, the short officer said quickly.
He'd been shyly glancing at her from a distance, lost in admiration.
I have full powers to grant you your request. When would you like to go?
Tomorrow. Oh, good, murmured Bruno. Tomorrow, so you'll be here when we leave. When are you leaving?
At 11 o'clock tonight. We're travelling at night because of the air raids. It seems a bit ridiculous since the moon is so bright it's almost like daytime. But the army works on tradition.
I'll be going now, said Lucille, after taking the two pieces of paper the short officer had written out. Two pieces of paper that symbolized a man's life and liberty. She calmly folded them up and slipped them under her waistband, without allowing the slightest sense of urgency to betray her nervousness. I'll be here when you go. Bruno looked at her, and she understood his silent plea. Will you come and say goodbye to me, Herr Lieutenant? I'm going out, but I'll be back at 6 o'clock.
The three young men stood up and clicked their heels. In the past, she'd found this display of courtesy by the soldiers of the Reich old-fashioned and rather affected.
Now, she thought how much she would miss this light jingling of spurs, the kiss on the hand, the admiration these soldiers showed her, almost in spite of themselves, soldiers who were without family, without female companionship, except for the lowest type of woman. There was, in their respect for her, a hint of tender melancholy. It was as if, thanks to her, they could recapture some remnant of their former lives, where kindness, a good education, politeness towards women had far more value than getting drunk or taking an enemy position. There was gratitude and nostalgia in their attitude towards her. She could sense it and was touched by it. She waited for it to be 8 o'clock in a state of deep anxiety. What would she say to him? How would they part? There was between them an entire world of confused, unexpressed thoughts, like a precious crystal, so fragile that a single word could shatter it. He felt it too, no doubt, for he spent only a brief moment alone with her. He took off his hat, perhaps his last civilian gesture, thought Lucille, feeling tender and sad, took her hands in his. Before kissing them, he pressed his cheek against hers, softly and urgently both at the same time. Was he claiming her as his own, attempting to brand her with his seal so she wouldn't forget? Adieu, he said. This is goodbye. I'll never forget you. Never. She stood silent. He looked at her and saw her eyes full of tears. He turned away. I'm going to give you the address of one of my uncles, he said after a moment. He's a von Falk like me, my father's brother. He's had a brilliant military career, and he's in Paris working for... He gave a very long German name. Until the end of the war, he will be the commandant in Greater Paris, a kind of viceroy, actually. And he depends on my uncle to help make decisions. I've told him about you, and asked that he help you as much as he can if you ever find yourself in difficulty. We're at war. God alone knows what might happen to all of us. You're very kind, Bruno, she said quietly.
At this moment she wasn't ashamed of loving him, because her physical desire had gone, and all she felt towards him now was pity and a profound, almost maternal tenderness. She forced herself to smile, like the Chinese mother who sent her son off to war, telling him to be careful, because war has its dangers. I'm asking you, if you have any feelings for me, to be as careful as possible with your life.
Because it is precious to you? He asked nervously.
Yes, because it is precious to me. Slowly they shook hands. She walked him out to the front steps. An orderly was waiting for him, holding the reins of his horse. It was late, but no one even considered going to bed. Everyone wanted to see the Germans leave. In these final hours, a kind of melancholy and human warmth bound them all together, the conquered and the conquerors. Big Erwalt, with the strong thighs, who held his drink so well and was so funny and robust. Short, nimble, cheerful Willie, who had learned some French songs. They said he was a real comedian in civilian life. Poor Johann, who had lost his whole family in an air raid. "Except for my mother-in-law," he said sadly, "because I never had much luck." All of them were about to be attacked, shot at, in danger of dying. How many of them would be buried on the Russian steppes? No matter how quickly, how successfully the war with Germany might finish, how many poor people would never see the blessed end, the new beginning. It was a wonderful night, clear, moonlit, without even a breath of wind. It was the time of year for cutting the branches of the lime trees, the time when men and boys climb up into the beautiful leafy trees and strip them bare, while down below, women and girls pick flowers from the sweet-smelling branches at their feet, flowers that will spend all summer drying in country lofts, and in winter will make herbal tea. A delicious, intoxicating perfume filled the air. How wonderful everything was. How peaceful. Children played and chased each other about. They climbed up onto the steps of the old stone cross and watched the road. "Can you see them?" their mothers asked.
"Not yet."
It had been decided that the regiment would assemble in front of the chateau and then parade through the village. From the shadow of doorways came the sound of kisses and whispered goodbyes, some more tender than others. The soldiers were in heavy helmets and field dress, gas masks hanging from their necks. The awaited drum roll came, and the men appeared, marching in rows of eight. With a final goodbye, a last blown kiss, the latecomers hurried to take their pre-assigned place, the place where destiny would find them. There was still the odd burst of laughter, a joke exchanged between the soldiers and the crowd. But soon, everyone fell silent. The general had arrived. He rode his horse past the troops, gave a brief salute to the soldiers and to the French, then left. Behind him followed the officers, then the grey car carrying the commandant with its motorcycle outriders. Then came the artillery, the cannons on their rolling platforms, the machine guns, the anti-aircraft guns pointing at the sky, and all the small but deadly weapons they'd watched go by during manoeuvres. They'd become accustomed to them, had looked at them indifferently without being afraid. But now, the sight of it all made them shudder. The truck, full to bursting with big loaves of black bread, freshly baked and sweet-smelling. The Red Cross vans, with no passengers, for now. The field kitchen, bumping along at the end of the procession like a saucepan tied to a dog's tail. The men began singing, a grave, slow song that drifted away into the night. Soon, the road was empty. All that remained of the German regiment was a little cloud of dust. Preface to the French edition by Miriam Anisimov. In 1929, the French publisher Bernard Garcet was so enthusiastic about a manuscript he had received in the post that he immediately decided to publish it. It was only as he was about to send a contract to the author of the novel, entitled David Golder, that he realised no name or address had been given, just a post office box number. He put an advertisement in the newspapers asking the mysterious author to make contact. When Irène Nemirovsky arrived to meet him a few days later, Bernard Grasset was astonished. How could this fashionable, cheerful young Russian woman, who had lived in France for only 10 years, have written a book that was so brilliantly daring, cruel, and mature? He questioned her carefully to make sure she wasn't standing in for a famous author who wished to remain anonymous. But as he did so, his admiration grew. Her French was impeccable. Although born in Kiev, she had learned it from her governess. As well as Russian, she knew Polish, Basque, English, Finnish, and a little Yiddish, a language she would make use of in her novel Les Chiens et les Loups, published in 1940. David Golder was an overnight success, unanimously acclaimed by the critics and admired by other writers.
However, the 26-year-old Irène Nemirovsky refused to be carried away by her sensational entry into the literary world. She was surprised that so much fuss was made over David Golder, which she considered, without false modesty, a minor novel. On the 22nd of January 1930, she wrote to a friend, "How could you think I could possibly forget my old friends because of a little book which people have been talking about for a few weeks, and which will be forgotten just as quickly, just as everything is forgotten in Paris?" Irène Nemirovsky was born in 1903 in Kiev, then part of the area known as Yiddish land, to which Russian Jews were confined. Her father's family came from the Ukrainian city of Nemirov, which had been an important centre of the Hasidic movement in the 18th century. Leon Nemirovsky had the misfortune to be born in 1868 in Elizabethgrad, the city where the great waves of pogroms against the Jews began in 1881. However, his family had prospered, becoming wealthy by trading in grain. As a young man, Leon had travelled widely before making his fortune in finance, going on to become one of the richest bankers in Russia. His business cards read, "Leon Nemirovsky, President and Managing Director of the Bank of Commerce of Voronezh, Administrator of the Union Bank of Moscow, Member of the Private Commercial Banking Committee of Petrograd." He bought an enormous private house overlooking St. Petersburg on a quiet street lined with gardens and lime trees. Irène was not a happy child. Her mother, who liked to be called Fanny, after her Hebrew name, Baiga, saw the birth of her daughter as the first sign of her declining youth and beauty. She felt a kind of aversion to Irène, for whom she never showed the least sign of love, and would spend hours in front of the mirror pampering herself, or away from home in search of extramarital affairs. She could not bear the idea that her looks would fade, or that she might turn into the kind of older woman who kept young men. She forced Irène to dress like a schoolgirl well into her teens, in order to convince herself that she wasn't growing older. Leon, whom Irène adored and admired, was always busy with his work, and most of the time was away or betting large sums of money at the casino. A lonely, solitary child, entrusted to the care of her governess, Irène took refuge in books and fought off despair by developing a ferocious hatred of her mother. This violent and unnatural relationship between mother and daughter would be at the heart of many of her novels, as would her disdain for her mother's wealthy Jewish milieu. In Russia, the Nemirovskys led a life of luxury. Every summer they would leave the Ukraine for the Crimean coast, Biarritz, Saint-Jean-de-Luz, Andey or the French Riviera. Irène's mother would take up residence in a villa, while Irène and her governess were sent to lodge with the family. At 14, after the death of her French teacher, Irène began writing. Settled on the sofa, a notebook on her lap, she developed a technique inspired by Ivan Turgenev. As well as the narrative itself, she would write down all the ideas the story inspired in her, without any revision or crossing out. She filled notebook upon notebook with thoughts about her characters, even the minor ones, describing their appearance, their education, their childhood, all the stages of their lives in chronological order. When each character had been detailed to this degree of precision, she would use two pencils, one red, the other blue, to underline the essential characteristics to be retained, sometimes only a few lines. She would then move quickly on to writing the novel, improving it, then editing the final version. In 1917, the Nemirovskys were still living in the large, beautiful house in St. Petersburg they'd occupied since 1914. Nemirovsky described the house in her autobiographical novel Le Vin de Solitude. The apartment was built in such a way that from the entrance hall you could see all the way back to the other rooms, a series of white and gold reception rooms that were visible through the large open doors. For a number of Russian writers and poets, St. Petersburg is a mythical city. To Irène Nemirovsky, it was nothing more than a collection of dark, snow-covered streets swept by the icy wind that rose from the disgusting, polluted canals of the Neva. When the October Revolution broke out, Leon Nemirovsky thought it expedient to move his family to Moscow,
since he frequently went there on business, and had sublet an apartment from an officer of the Imperial Guard who had been assigned to the Russian embassy in London. His plan proved misguided. Moscow was where the more violent fighting took place, and the family were trapped in the apartment for 5 days, their only food a bag of potatoes, some chocolate and sardines. Wedged in between other apartment blocks and surrounded by a courtyard, the house was hidden from the street. While battles raged outside, Irene explored the officer's library. There she discovered Huysmans, de Maupassant, Plato and Oscar Wilde. The Portrait of Dorian Gray was her favourite book. When the street was deserted, she would quietly go down to pick up the empty cartridges. During a lull in the fighting, the Nemirovskis went back to St. Petersburg, but the Bolsheviks had put a price on Leon's head and he was forced into hiding. In December 1917, taking advantage of the fact that the borders had not yet been closed, Leon Nemirovsky made arrangements for his family to travel to Finland, disguised as peasants. Irene spent a year in a little hamlet consisting of 3 wooden houses in the middle of a snowfield. She still hoped to return to Russia, and the wait seemed long. While they were there, her father returned to Russia several times, in disguise, to try and rescue their belongings. Yet despite the uncertainty and lack of comfort, Nemirovsky experienced for the first time a period of serenity and peace. She was absorbed by her writing, composing prose poems inspired by Oscar Wilde. With the situation in Russia deteriorating and the Bolsheviks drawing dangerously nearer to them, the Nemirovskys moved on to Sweden, finally reaching Stockholm after a long journey. They spent 3 months in the Swedish capital, where Irene would always remember the mauve lilacs growing in the courtyards and gardens. Then, in early 1919, the family took a small cargo boat for France, sailing for 10 days through a terrible storm, which inspired the dramatic final scene in David Golder. Safe in Paris, Leon Nemirovsky took over as director of a branch of his bank and so managed to rebuild his fortune. Irene had always loved France, and in Paris her life changed utterly. She enrolled at the Sorbonne, where she graduated with a distinction in literature, and began sending stories to magazines. In 1927, she published a novella called L'Enfant Génial, about a young Jewish boy from the slums of Odessa who seduces an aristocrat with his poetry. The Nemirovskys were soon assimilated into French society and led the glamorous life of the wealthy upper middle class, fashionable soirees, champagne dinners, balls, luxurious holidays. Irene adored dancing. She dashed between parties, living, as she herself admitted, the high life. Sometimes she gambled at the casino. On the 2nd of January 1924, she wrote to a friend, "I have had the wildest week, one ball after another, and I'm still a bit heady and finding it difficult to get back into the routine of work." Another time she wrote from Nice, "I'm behaving like a madwoman. It's shameful. I dance all night long. Every evening there are very chic entertainments in different hotels, and as my lucky star has blessed me with a few handsome young men, I'm enjoying myself very much indeed." A further letter, written just after a return from Nice, reads, "I haven't behaved very well, for a change. The evening before I left, there was a grand ball at our hotel, the Negresco. I danced like a mad thing until 2 a.m. and went outside in the freezing cold to drink champagne and flirt." A few days later, she wrote, "Tura came to see me and lectured me for 2 hours. It seems that I flirt too much and that it's bad to upset boys like that. I broke off with Henry, you know, and he came to see me the other day looking pale, wide-eyed and evil, with a revolver in his pocket." In the whirlwind of one of these parties, she met Michel Epstein, a small, dark-haired man with a very swarthy complexion who wasted no time in courting her. He had a degree in physical and electronic engineering from the University of St. Petersburg and worked as a senior banking executive at the Banque des Pays du Nord, Rue Gaillon. She liked him, flirted, and in 1926 they were married. They moved to 10 Avenue Constant Coquelin, a beautiful apartment on the left bank, whose windows looked out over the large courtyard of a convent.
In 1929, Irène gave birth to Denise. Fanny sent a teddy bear. By the time her second daughter, Elisabeth, was born in 1937, David Golder had been turned into a film, and she had published 9 novels. She and Michelle moved in high circles and took holidays in fashionable spa towns for Irène's asthma. In spite of her fame, and though clearly very attached to her new country, Irène still didn't have French citizenship. In 1939, Irène decided that she and her children should convert to Catholicism. This decision should be seen in the context of the obsessive fear of war in 1939 and the previous decade of violent anti-Semitism, during which Jews had been portrayed as evil invaders and power-hungry warmongers, a race of bourgeois merchants and revolutionaries. She and her family were baptized early in the morning of the 2nd of February, 1939, in the chapel of Sainte-Marie in Paris by a family friend, Prince Ghica, a Romanian bishop. When war broke out in September, Irène and Michel took their 2 small daughters, Denise and Elisabeth, to the safety of Issy-l'Évêque in Saint-Éloi, the village where their nanny, Cécile Michaud, came from. There, they were left in the care of Cécile's mother, Madame Mitaine. For the first months of the war, Irène and Michel stayed in Paris, making frequent journeys to visit their children. Then in June 1940, the Germans occupied Paris, and the Nemirovskis decided to leave Paris altogether, taking up residence in a hotel opposite the house of Cécile Michaud, the Hôtel des Voyageurs. From then on, life became increasingly difficult. On the 3rd of October 1940, a law was passed giving Jews inferior legal and social standing. Most important, it defined, based on racial criteria, who was to be considered Jewish in the French state. The Nemirovskis, who took part in an enforced census in June 1941, were both Jewish and foreign. Their baptism certificates were useless. Michel no longer had the right to work at the bank. The publishing houses were Aryanizing their personnel and authors, so Irène could no longer be published. Further race laws passed in October 1940 and June 1941 stipulated that Jews could be placed under house arrest or deported and interned in concentration camps. Issy-l'Évêque was now in the occupied zone, and the Hôtel des Voyageurs was full of German soldiers. Irène, her husband and her daughters all openly wore the Jewish star. Irène Nemirovsky watched what was happening with pitiless clarity. She had no doubt that these events would result in tragedy. But life went on. Denise celebrated her first communion despite going to the local school with the Jewish star sewn prominently onto the front of her coat. Michel amused himself by writing a multiplication table for Denise in rhyme. The family was finally able to find a large house to rent. Irène read and wrote constantly. Every day, after breakfast, she would go out, sometimes walking for 10 kilometres before finding a spot she liked. Then she would start working. Between 1940 and 1942, the publishing house Albin Michel and the director of the anti-Semitic newspaper Gringoire agreed to help her publish her short stories under various pseudonyms. She also wrote A Life of Chekhov and a novel, Les Feux de l'Automne, which would not be published until 1957. But most important, in 1941, she started work on an ambitious novel to be called Suite Française. Nemirovsky began Suite Française, as was her habit, by writing notes on the work in progress and thoughts inspired by the situation in France. She created a list of characters, both major and minor, then checked that she had used them correctly. She dreamed of a book of 1,000 pages, constructed like a symphony, but in 5 sections, according to rhythm and tone. She took Beethoven's 5th symphony as a model. On the 12th of June 1942, she began to doubt she would be able to complete this huge endeavour. She had a premonition that she didn't have long to live. But she continued work on her book, simultaneously writing notes. She called these lucid, cynical remarks, Notes sur l'état de France, notes on the state of France. They proved that she had absolutely no illusions, not about the attitude of the inert French masses, loathsome in their defeat and collaboration,
nor about her own fate. As she wrote at the top of the first page, "To lift such a heavy weight, Sisyphus, you will need all your courage. I do not lack the courage to complete the task, but the goal is far, and time is short." In her writing, she denounced fear, cowardice, acceptance of humiliation, of persecution and massacre. She was alone. It was rare to find anyone in the literary and publishing worlds who did not choose to collaborate with the Nazis. Every day, Irene would go to meet the postman, but there were increasingly few letters from her publishers. She did not try to escape her fate by fleeing, to Switzerland, for example, which was taking in a small number of Jews coming from France, especially women and children. She saw the situation in such bleak terms that on the 3rd of June she wrote her will and gave it to the children's governess, asking that she take care of Denise and Elisabeth if necessary. She gave precise instructions, listing all the possessions she had managed to save, which could be sold to provide money to pay the rent, heat the house, buy a stove, hire a gardener who would tend the vegetable garden to provide food while rationing lasted. She provided the addresses of her daughter's doctors and details of their diet. Not a word of revolt. A straightforward understanding of the situation, exactly as it was. Hopeless. On the 3rd of July, she wrote, "Just let it be over, one way or the other." She saw the situation as a succession of violent shocks that could kill her. On the 11th of July, she was working in the pine forest, sitting on her blue cardigan, in the middle of an ocean of rotting leaves drenched by last night's storm, as if on a raft, my legs folded beneath me. That day she wrote a letter to her editor at Albin Michel that left no doubt about her certainty that she would not survive the war. "My dear friend, think of me sometimes. I have done a lot of writing. I suppose they will be posthumous works, but it helps pass the time." On the 13th of July 1942, the French police knocked at the Nemirovskys' door. They had come to arrest Irene. On the 16th of July, she was interned in the concentration camp at Pithiviers in the Loiret region. The next day, she was deported to Auschwitz in convoy number 6. She was registered at the extermination camp at Birkenau, and as she was very weak, she was sent to the Reviers, the infirmary at Auschwitz, where prisoners who were too ill to work were confined in atrocious conditions. The SS would periodically pile them into trucks and take them to the gas chambers. She died on the 17th of August, 1942. When Irene was taken away, Michel did not understand that to be arrested and deported meant certain death. Every day he expected her to come home and insisted at mealtimes that her place be set at the table. In complete despair, he wrote to Marshal Pétain to explain that his wife had a delicate constitution and to request permission to take her place in the labour camp. In October 1942, the Vichy government responded by arresting him. He was first imprisoned at Creusot, then Drancy, where his search document shows that 8,500 francs were taken from him. On the 6th of November 1942, he too was deported to Auschwitz and was sent straight to the gas chamber. Immediately after arresting Michel Epstein, the police went to the village school to get Denise, but her schoolteacher hid her behind her bed. The police did not give up and continued their hunt. The Nemirovskys' governess had the presence of mind to remove the Jewish star from their clothes and flee the village with the little girls. They spent the rest of the war moving between hiding places. The first was a Catholic boarding school, where two of the nuns knew the little girls were Jewish. There, Denise was given a false name, but she never managed to get used to it, so she was often scolded in class because she didn't reply when she was called. But the French police, who it seems had little better to do than hunt down two children so they might share the same fate as their parents, picked up their trail. The girls were forced to leave the convent to hide out in a series of cellars in the region of Bordeaux. Whenever they boarded a train to move on, the governess would tell Denise to hide her nose. When Denise caught a chest infection, the people who were hiding her didn't help her to see a doctor. The war over, the two girls returned to Paris and went to their grandmother's house to ask for help. Fanny had spent the war years in Nice, living in great comfort, But when the children rang the doorbell, she refused to let them in, shouting through the closed door that if their parents were dead, they should go to an orphanage. Fanny died in 1972 in a large apartment in Paris on the Avenue President Wilson. The only things found in her safe were two books by her daughter, Jezebel and David Golder. Each day, wearing a sign with their names written on it, Denise and Elisabeth would make their way to the platform of the Gare de l'Est, where trains carrying the survivors of the concentration camps were beginning to arrive. They would also go to the Hôtel Lutetia, which had been turned into a reception centre for returning deportees. Once, Denise began to run down the street after a woman because she thought she recognised her mother. But eventually, it became clear that their parents were not coming back. That the manuscript of Suite Française should have survived in such circumstances is extraordinary. It was Denise who put it into a suitcase as she and her sister fled Issy-l'Évêque. She'd often watched her mother writing, in tiny handwriting to save ink and paper, in the large leather-bound notebook. She took it as a memento of her mother. The suitcase accompanied Denise and Elisabeth from one precarious hiding place to another. After the war, they couldn't bring themselves to read the notebook. Having it was enough. Once, Denise tried to look inside to see what was there, but it was too painful. Many years passed, and she and her sister Elisabeth, who had become an editor in a publishing house under the name Elisabeth Gilles, agreed they should entrust their mother's notebook to the Institut Mémoire de l'Édition Contemporaine, an organisation dedicated to documenting memories of the war, in order to preserve it. Before giving it up, Denise decided to type it out. With the help of a large magnifying glass, she began the long, difficult task of deciphering the minuscule handwriting. Soon she discovered that these were not simply notes or a private diary, as she had thought, but a violent masterpiece, a fresco of extraordinary lucidity, a vivid snapshot of France and the French, spineless, defeated and occupied. Here was the exodus from Paris, villages invaded by exhausted, hungry women and children battling to find a place to sleep, if only a chair in a country inn. Cars piled high with furniture, mattresses and pots and pans, running out of petrol and left abandoned in the roads. The rich trying to save their precious jewels. A German soldier falling in love with a French woman under the watchful eye of her mother-in-law. The simple dignity of a modest couple searching amid the chaos of the convoys fleeing Paris for a trace of their wounded son. Denise Epstein sent the manuscript to the publisher De Noël. 64 years after Nemirovsky's death, we are finally able to read the last work of a writer who had held a mirror up to France at its darkest hour. When Denise Epstein entrusted the manuscript of Suite Française to the archives, she felt tremendous sadness that her sister, Elisabeth Gilles, who died in 1996, had not been able to read it. Elisabeth had herself written Le Mirador, The Watchtower, a magnificent, imagined biography of the mother she never had the chance to know. She was only 5 years old when Irene Nemirovsky died in Auschwitz. Suite Française by Irene Nemirovsky was read by Carol Boyd and is published by BBC Audiobooks.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this programme.